The woman you're about to hear from next has been in front of audiences around the country and around the world more times than she could begin to count.
Usually when people introduce me, they can go for a half hour. It makes me feel as if I'm at my own wake or something. You know, and then in 1951, But the truth is, I'm Maya Angelou, whatever that means to whomever it means, because my mother loved me and my grandmother loved me and my brother loved me. And they all told me I could do whatever I wanted to do.
Dr. Maya Angelou has lived an extraordinary life, the author of dozens of books, a professor, poet, and recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. But Angelou says none of it would have been possible without the support of a woman named Vivian Baxter, her mother. Angelou's new memoir focuses on that relationship. It's called Mom and Me and Mom. When I spoke recently with Dr. Angelou, we started out talking about her childhood and a terrible event that left her mute for several years.
At one time in my life, from the time I was 7 until I was about 13, I didn't speak. I only spoke to my brother. The reason I didn't speak, I had been molested, and I told the name of the molester to my brother, who told it to the family. The man was put in jail for one day and night and released. And about 3 days later, the police came over to my mother's house and told her that the man had been found dead, and it seemed he had been kicked to death. They made that pronouncement in my earshot, and I thought my voice killed the man. And so it's better not to speak. So for 6 years, I didn't speak. I was sent back to my father's mother, who was raising me in Arkansas, and my grandmother said to me, "Sister, Mama don't care what these people say, that you must be an idiot or you must be a moron because you can't speak. Mama don't care. Mama know when you and the good Lord get ready. Sister, you're going to teach all over this world."
In your early childhood, you were raised by your grandmother. Eventually, you found your way back to your birth mother.
Yes, I did.
That was a tough reunion. In the beginning, you didn't want to call her mother. You called her
Lady.
Can you explain why?
Yes. Well, she didn't look like a mother to me. She didn't remind me of my grandmother, who we call Mama. And she wore lipstick, and she had record players, and she played music loudly and danced in the middle of the dining room floor. She said after a few weeks, "You're going to have to address me." And she asked, "What would you like to call me?" I said, "I'd like to call you Lady, because you're very beautiful, and you sound like a lady." She said, "All right, I'll be Lady. So everyone must address me as Lady from now on." So all sorts of people know her only as Lady. But after a few years, she won me. She won me over because she was kind. And then she was also funny. So I liked all that, and she just won me over. And then I heard myself calling her mother, and before I knew it, I was calling her Mom.
She was such a support for you.
Yes, she was.
But you do include a scene in the book that is, it's powerful and it's difficult. It's when you're a young girl, I think you're still in high school, you're growing up in San Francisco, you stay out very late with friends, you know you're going to get in trouble. But when you go home, you're not just in trouble, she wallops you.
I know, she hit me. She had a handful of keys, about 20 keys on a chain. And I came through the door. Before I could say anything, she hit me with her fist. My stepfather came down from upstairs to see what was happening. She was still cursing like a drunk seaman. Then my brother came down and said, "We're leaving here." And my mother asked, "Where the do you think you're going?" He said, "We're leaving this house. No one beats up my baby sister." And she said, "Please come in the kitchen. Let me speak to you. Please come. Please come." She took a cloth off a rack and put it down on the floor. Then she knelt on the cloth, and she prayed to God to forgive her. Then she prayed to me, and she cried so piteously. She said, I just had come down the steps. I'd gone to your room. and you weren't in, and it's 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And I thought of what that man did to you in St. Louis when you were a little girl, 7 years old. And I thought maybe someone was taking advantage of me. And I was about crazy. And then I came down the steps, and just then you pushed open the door with a big smile on your face. She said, I hit you before I thought of it. Please forgive me. I forgave her immediately.
What changed in your relationship as a result of that event?
Well, it was so gradual that they became woven into the psyche, which is the fabric of my psyche. The large changes I remember, and I can say, I was the first black person to be on the streetcars in San Francisco, a conductorette. And my mother had asked me, what would you like to do this semester? You're the head of your class. What would you like to do? You have to work. So I said, I'd like to be a streetcar conductor. She said, all right, go get the job.
And on your first day, your mom decided that she would drive you before dawn.
She drove me for as long as I kept the job, which was a few months. And she'd drive right behind the streetcar until daylight. And at daylight, she'd honk her horn and blow me a kiss.
We should also point out a big reason why she was following you in those early daylight hours. She had a gun along with her. She wanted to protect you.
Absolutely. I told her that's what you were. You were my great protection. She said I was more than that. You were mine, too. I can't describe her except that she gave off an energy. She was short. I mean, she was 5'5". I'm 6 foot. She used to move a lot, like shaking. And I'd say, why do you move like that? She said, my motor is running.
Did you get that from her? Do you move a lot? Do you got to move your body?
Oh, yes. Well, I don't move that way. But I was a dancer for many years. I was a premier dancer with Porgy and Bess, the opera. And I taught dance in different places.
Many people might not know that about you. You did have a dance career. You started out as a dancer, almost, is it fair to say it was kind of a strip club?
Well, I did work in a strip club, but I didn't strip. I danced, and I became very popular. And the band was so used to playing for the strippers, and they'd use it, and they just didn't even look anymore. They were so bored and blasé. But then I came, and I said, do caravan, and all that. And I would hit the floor and dance my skin off almost. And I moved from a strip joint to a cabaret.
When did you find your voice as a writer?
Well, I liked to write from the time I was about 12 or 13. I loved to read. And since I only spoke to my brother, I would write down my thoughts. And I think I wrote some of the worst poetry west of the Rockies. But by the time I was in my 20s, I found myself writing little essays and more poetry, writing at writing.
Do you remember any of your very early poems? Maybe something you wish you hadn't written?
No. Oh, a poet does not see the writing on the wall. She sees the wall, that's all. But for tomorrow goes her clarion call, for others do not see the wall. Yes, that's a mine. My Lord.
When did you write that?
About 70 years ago. And amazing.
What happens in your day if you find yourself with one or two sacred hours of free time? What does Dr. Maya Angelou do?
That's a wonderful question, because it would depend on what kind of day it is. If it's a good spring or summer day, I'll probably be in my garden. Or I'll be maybe cooking something that catches my fancy. Hmm. One thing that's nice to cook are whipped cream puffs. They're so easy, and yet people think they're so difficult, and they're so complimentary.
Wow, it sounds hard to me.
No, I promise you. When you see how easy it is and how delicious they can be, make it for your beloved. Make it for your family, someone in the family. Then someone you really want to impress. Just put it out. Oh, yes, I have this. Ah,
this whole thing, this batch of cream puffs.
Yes, and eclairs.
At this point in your life, do you think about the word legacy?
Well, I don't. I'm not ready to do that yet. Unless the Creator is ready for me, I'm not going anywhere. So, and instead of having 33 books or whatever they are, I might have 40. I just really want to say this. I dedicate this book to my son, Guy Bailey Johnson, who's the bravest, most courageous, and most generous man I've ever known.
Dr. Maya Angelou, her new memoir is called Mom and Me and Mom. Dr. Angelou, thank you so much. It's just been a pleasure.
Thank you very, very much.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
One night in 1910, a little girl is born during a snowstorm in the English countryside. The baby has a cord wrapped around her neck. She turns blue and gasps for life. The doctor can't make it through the snow, and the little girl dies. Then that same little girl is born on another night in 1910, but this time the doctor trudges through the storm, delivers the baby, and stays for breakfast. The little girl becomes Ursula. She's joyful and happy, but on a beach outing with her family when she's five, she's slurped up by a wave while she's holding the hand of her sister. Ursula dies again. But then on another afternoon, the wave crashes against her. This time an amateur painter is set up nearby who sees Ursula and her sister and clambers into the water and plucks them up both. Ursula's parents treat him to tea. End of story? Never. Really. The many lives and deaths of Ursula Todd are related, interlocked, and grow in and out of each other. In Kate Atkinson's new novel, Life After Life. And Kate Atkinson, the Whitbread Award-winning author of previous novels, including Case Histories, joins us from the BBC in Edinburgh. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
This novel is so intricately plotted.
Uh-huh.
I have to ask, did you write it out on shirt cardboards, index cards, a tapestry like the, you know, Bayeux Tapestry? Is this all done by computer program? How'd you manage it?
This, to me, was much easier to write than the previous four novels because they were, to all intents and purposes, crime novels. And they are tapestries. That's a very good analogy for them because it's two steps forward, one step back. You're always going back and putting something in because it's all about clues and plotting. Whereas this, because I knew where I was going to start and I knew where I wanted to end and I knew that it was all about her being born, always going to come back to February the 11th, 1910, in a snowstorm. So it was a much more rhythmic way of writing. I just started at the beginning and wrote to the end. It was actually relatively easy.
As I've been telling people, this is not, to my mind, a novel about the road not taken so much as this is a book that takes every road.
Yes. That's true.
Which prompts the question, is Ursula Todd the same character, life after life?
Yes, she's definitely the same character. But I think what happens is, I mean, she has all these lives, but she learns and she doesn't always correct. And she certainly doesn't always correct in the right way, mm-hmm. but she changes and she changes things. Not that she improves herself, I think, but that she gets stronger and she gets more courageous.
Does having Ursula die so often only to be returned to life risk making death somehow less resonant?
For me, it actually simply compounded it so that it was a layer upon layer of awfulness, really. We should point out that this isn't a novel entirely mired in gloom and doom. There are some lighter moments in it. But
it can be incredibly funny, too. But part of that, I must say, as a reader, is that the first couple of times she died, I wept.
Mm.
By the fourth or fifth time.
Yeah, you were like, here she goes again.
Yes, exactly. And what's going to happen next? Which is not bad, but there's a part of me that thinks that death ought to be saved to make a point.
But did you not think by the time she died in the Berlin Blitz that you'd come around to thinking that was incredibly sad again?
Yes, I was weeping.
She dies a lot in the first third of the book, but I would say in the second two-thirds of the book she actually dies very little. Until we get to the Blitz, she has a whole cascade of horrible deaths in the Blitz. But after we've set the pattern, I think there's less of that. So it changes, it alters. Sometimes it's very sad, sometimes it's poignant, sometimes it's rather offhand, I think.
The Blitz is, for those of us who love Britain, this is the Odyssey. This is the Iliad. This is the great story of the British character. But you weren't around for it in person. And I wonder what kind of research you did, aside from watching some fabulous old movies, I'm sure.
Well, I was born in 51, so in a way I just missed it. And I think they do say it's the period of history you just miss that becomes the one that interests you most, isn't it? But I think with the Blitz, I think it's such an intense period. I forget how many days, it's 57 or 58 days of continuous bombing, or nights of continuous bombing, sometimes daytime bombing. And you do wonder what effect that has on character and on how people feel. So I read a lot of first-hand accounts and was impressed, really, by the stoicism. I think out of all the words I would use for how people behaved, it would be stoic. You know, you have to peel away lots of layers of propaganda because there's an immense amount of propaganda in Britain in the Second World War, which was deemed necessary to keep morale up. So you have to sort of see through that to how people were really feeling and behaving. But I, you know, if I could choose a period to go back to, I think I would like to live through the Blitz, because you do read so many accounts of people say that they were living their lives at such an intense pitch that it was a completely different way of living.
As a novelist, do you try out different paths in your novel before you settle on one?
I usually try different novels. I usually start writing a novel that I then abandon. When I say abandon, I don't think any writer ever abandons anything that they regard as even a half good sentence. So you recycle. I mean, I can hang on to a sentence for several years and then put it into a book that's completely different from the one it started in. So I think it's, you sort of nose your way into it, I think.
Kate Atkinson, her new novel, Life After Life. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Were people happier in the 1950s than they are today? Or were they more frustrated, repressed, more sad? Is it even possible to compare the emotions of one generation to another? Well, a recently published study may offer a few answers. A group of researchers used a computer program to analyze the emotional content of books from every year of the 20th century, billions of words in millions of books. NPR's Elise Spiegel reports on one of the strange findings this process produced.
There are so many words for sad.
Weepy, grievous, hangdog, shamefaced.
And apparently
shame,
even more for joyful.
Gusto, relish, glee, zest.
Alex Bentley, the man that you hear speaking, is an anthropologist at the University of Bristol. And several years ago, he and some colleagues got interested in words that convey emotion. They wanted to track the use of those words over time and see if certain words at certain moments became more popular.
Panic, terror, hysteria, horror.
This was 2010, and Google had been digitizing books for several years. In fact, at that point, Google had digitized about 4% of all the books ever published. So Bentley and his co-authors turned to a database Google had created to allow researchers like them to search all these books that they had digitized and sent their computers hurtling through time. Bentley says they did this more or less on a lark.
We didn't really expect to find anything. We were just curious, but the clarity of some of the patterns was surprising to all of us, I think.
Bentley says the computers analyzed six categories of emotion: sadness, joy, anger, disgust, surprise, and fear. And when the researchers began, they expected the use of words describing these emotions to be more or less constant. Instead, they found very distinct peaks and valleys. With the graphs spread out in front of him, Bentley says it is easy to see.
The 20s were the highest peak of joy-related words that we see. So they were roaring.
But then there's 1941.
1941, sadness is at its peak.
41, of course, marks the beginning of America's entry into the Second World War. And it doesn't take a historian to see that peaks and valleys like these roughly mirror the major economic and social events of the century, which Bentley found interesting because the books in the database are on an incredibly wide range of topics. They're not just novels or writing about current events. Many are books without clear emotional content, technical manuals about plants and animals, automotive repair guides.
It's not like the change in emotions is because people are writing about the Depression and people are writing about the war. There might be a little bit of that, but this is like averaged over all books, and it's just kind of creeping in.
Which brings us to the most surprising finding of the study. We think of modern culture, and often of ourselves, as more emotionally open than people in the past. We live in a world of reality television and blogs and Facebook. It feels like feelings are everywhere, displayed in these ways that they never were before. But according to this research, that's not so.
Generally speaking, the usage of these commonly known emotion words has all been in decline over the 20th century.
In other words, we used words that expressed our emotions less in the year 2000 than we did 100 years earlier. Words like
blue, dark, depressing,
or
glee, gusto, relish.
These words, Bentley says, have been slowly but surely declining. You can see it on the graphs.
Joyless.
In fact, there is only one exception that Bentley and his colleagues found.
Fear.
Fear increased steadily up until the year 2000 when the study ends.
The fear-related words start to increase just before the 1980s.
So what does this tell us? Should we trust it? Could it be that our own sense of ourselves and how emotionally open we are is somehow wrong? Bentley says he frankly does not know why it would be that books include fewer emotional words today than they did 100 years ago.
We were just so surprised at this result that we just wanted to publish it to show people. And we don't in the paper have an answer for everything, particularly the decline in emotion-related words through time. But it's just such a fascinating thing. I'm excited just to hear other people's interpretations of this data.
The general strategy is a really promising way for us to think about emotions in history.
This is James Pennebaker, a psychologist at the University of Texas, who also has done language studies on big databases like this. And Pennebaker says he is uncertain about this conclusion, that the use of emotional content words has decreased over time.
I think it's a little early to know.
This is one of the first studies that's tried to analyze emotional words in this way, he says, and this kind of analysis is very complicated. Still, Pennebaker believes that this method of mining vast amounts of written language like books is incredibly promising. For psychologists, he says, there are only a handful of ways to try to understand what is actually going on with somebody emotionally.
One is what a person says, kind of the self-report of emotion. Another might be the physiological links. And the third is what slips out when they're talking to other people, when they're writing a book or something like that.
For years, psychologists like Pennebaker have worried that self-report does not always accurately reflect what's going on with someone, and physiological measures are hard to get, which is why this language analysis seems promising to him, a new window which might offer a different, maybe even more objective view into our culture, because it's difficult for people today to guess the emotions of people of different times.
Our current emotional state completely biases our memories of the past and our expectations for the future. And using these language samples, we are able to peg how people are feeling over time. And that's what I love about it as a historical marker. So we can get a sense of how groups of people or entire cultures might have felt 10 years ago or 100 years ago.
It's a kind of emotional archaeology, he says, from traces left behind by our words. Elise Spiegel NPR News, Washington.
Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has a review of Elizabeth Strout's new novel, The Burgess Boys. Strout is best known for her short story collection, Olive Kittredge, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2009.
In 1846, Edgar Allan Poe wrote a famous essay called The Philosophy of Composition, in which he sounds like an interior decorator. I say that because in the essay, Poe insisted that all good writing must strive for what he called unity of effect. For Poe, it was important that everything in his short stories, characters, setting, narration, add up to one big, color-me-terrified impact. I kept thinking of Poe's matchy-matchy theory of writing as I was reading Elizabeth Strout's new novel, The Burgess Boys. I bet Poe would have preferred Strout's Olive Kitteridge, given that it's a collection of interlocking short stories. Poe always had a thing for short poems and stories over novels. Not only is The Burgess Boys a novel, it's a big, floppy, shambling jumble sale of a novel. I mostly loved it because it feels like life. Color it chaotic. The Burgess Boys grew up in Strout's trademark territory of rural Maine. Their dying hometown burg is called Shirley Falls, but as adults they've escaped to New York. Jim is a famous corporate lawyer who's always belittled his younger brother, Bob, also a lawyer, but a less prosperous one, for legal aid. Jim calls Bob slob dog, but his fraternal teasing has a nasty edge to it, historically speaking. As little boys, the two were left alone with their sister in the family car parked at the top of a hill. Bob accidentally switched gears into drive and the car rolled, killing their father, who was bending over in front of it. Growing up in Shirley Falls, Bob was known as the one who killed his father, and well into middle age now, he still seems to be atoning for that original sin. The plot gets going with a surprise phone call from the Burgess boy's sister, Susan, the sibling who stayed behind in Maine. She's divorced, works in an eyeglass store, and lives in a dilapidated house that she can barely afford to heat in winter. Susan breaks the news that her teenage son, Zach, is being arrested and charged with a hate crime. It turns out Shirley Falls has become a resettlement area for Somali refugees, and Zach was caught rolling a frozen, bloody pig's head through the door of a storefront mosque. The Somalians, as Susan and many of the other townspeople call them, are especially outraged because this violation occurred during Ramadan. Zach, a lonely boy who seems scared of his own shadow, says he doesn't even know what Ramadan is. In the days and months that follow, Jim and Bob, separately and together, return again and again to Shirley Falls to try to straighten this mess out. Along the way, our sense of who these two men are expands and changes. Strout's roving narrator also takes us into their sister Susan's narrow world and into the traumatized lives of some of the Somali refugees. This is an ambitious novel that wants to train its gaze on the flotsam and jetsam of thought, as well as on big issue topics like the politics of immigration and the possibility of second chances. The Burgess Boys can be overly sentimental sometimes and too contrived, but Strout can really nail things in her precise but unprissy language. At one point, Susan, who's not adept at expressing herself, thinks about all the things that have gone wrong in her life, the things she'd like to change. And our omniscient narrator, speaking for Susan, starkly says, "It was too late." No one wants to believe something is too late, but it is always becoming too late, and then it is. The most resonant parts of The Burgess Boys, however, are the long, sprawling sections that delve into the family dynamics, especially the damaged, delusional, yet still essential relationship between Jim and Bob. It's because this novel is messy and wrinkled and digressive that it ultimately rings true. Don't look for unity of effect in the Burgess Boys. Rather, savor the authenticity of imperfection.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Burgess Boys by Elizabeth Strout. The season premiere of Mad Men is Sunday. Coming up, our TV critic David Bianculli has a review. This is Fresh Air.
David Sheff wrote a book in 2008 that became a kind of landmark. Beautiful Boy was a painful, personal story of the battle he tried to fight with and alongside his son Nick against his son's addiction to methamphetamines. The book became an international bestseller and made David Sheff one of the country's most prominent voices on addiction, not as a doctor, an addict, or an academic expert, but as a father. David Sheff has continued to try to figure out a road that can lead out of addiction, and he tries to present that route in his new book, Clean, Overcoming Addiction and Ending America's Greatest Tragedy. David Sheff joins us from the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco. Thanks so much for being with us.
Scott, thanks so much for having me.
And first, can we ask, how's Nick doing?
Well, he's doing just great. Most importantly, he's sober 5 years, and which is a miracle. I mean, he nearly died so many times. God, he's married. He has a great circle of friends. So, it was unimaginable for a while ago. I mean, I didn't think he was going to make it to 21, but last summer he turned 30.
Oh, good for all of you.
Thank you.
What do you think is the first item many of us get wrong about addiction?
Well, I guess it's this very deeply ingrained idea that addicts are choosing to get high, and so they are reprehensible and they're, weak. But what we know now is that, addicts aren't immoral. They aren't weak. They're ill. They have a disease. And for me, when I finally realized that about Nick, that he was sick, he wasn't, that's what explained this just unconscionable, crazy behavior. It allowed me to look at him with compassion and to figure out, instead of with anger, just how do I help him? How do we save his life?
And yet to help someone or to help them help themselves, isn't it necessary to believe that they, if they didn't choose to become addicted, they can at least make choices that can lift them out of that morass, that they can help themselves?
Well, this is one of the most complicated diseases there is because this is a brain disease. So the nature of this disease, the thinking is impaired, the sort of self-preservation mechanisms, everything is about getting drugs. It's a biological, force. Drugs shift the way that we think. So, yeah, the logical thing would be to get help, but that's not the way addicts operate, which is why it's really, really hard to get someone to understand that they need treatment. If we catch this early, it's not as difficult to get someone into treatment. Almost every addict started using when they were teenagers. So that's when we want to try to intervene, early stages of just marijuana use, alcohol use. It's a lot easier to prevent things from escalating.
Do you think it is preventable?
I know it's preventable. I mean, the way we've done it in the past, doesn't work. The just say no doesn't work. We had police officers coming in, showing pictures of, of horror stories, a little bit the Reefer Madness kind of era. Mm-hmm. They show a drug addict on the street passed out. And, kids in the audience who are teenagers, might smoke some pot at that point, and they just can't relate to that. So instead, we know that fact-based education works. Parents, teachers, and others, if we learn about, the risk factors, stress, certainly if somebody has mental illness, they're more likely to use drugs. If they're experiencing some trauma, divorce in their lives, I mean, we have to help kids through those things. And also we have to pay a lot of attention. A doctor that I interviewed said, if you think something's wrong, and that's the time to figure it out, get help, drag a kid to therapy if that's what it takes to get some advice from a doctor. You find someone who is trained in addiction medicine, and they can put you on a course. There are some treatment programs that use, evidence-based treatment rather than sort of this best guess and pseudoscience, and, that's the goal.
More and more states are legalizing marijuana one way or another right now. You seem to be skeptical that that's a good idea.
Well, actually, I support legalization, but, there's a lot of people that support legalization who say things that are just wrong. They say that marijuana should be legalized because it's harmless, it's natural, and no one has ever died from marijuana. You can't get addicted to marijuana. Well, those things are all untrue. Marijuana is not innocuous. There's a lot of research. This is, again, it's especially pertains to teenagers. I mean, their brains are developing. Marijuana, you know, changes the development. They can see the difference in the gray matter. There's the effects include, you know, problems with their cognition and memory and motivation. And there's some evidence that it even lowers IQ. So, you know, I think that we need to legalize pot so we can start a new conversation and deal with this for what it is. I mean, it's not a criminal problem and shouldn't be treated as a criminal problem. It's a health problem. So we need to focus on education and not punishment.
David, what are, in your experience and judgment, some of the reasons that so many treatment programs seem just not to work for people?
90% of the treatment programs in America are based on the 12-step model. Now, it's really important for me to say that, you know, the 12 steps, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous have saved millions of lives. I mean, it's a really, really profound program.
And I will add, there are many people who say that only Alcoholics Anonymous and that 12-step program worked.
Right. And so that's where I, you know, that's my problem. I don't object to AA at all, only the programs that insist that it's the only way to get clean and to stay clean.
You take on quite a few programs, actually, not just AA. What are some of the reasons a lot of treatment programs don't work, in your judgment?
These programs often are run by the only credentials that rehab counselors have in some places is that they're an addict who's in recovery. You want to go into programs that are accredited because they use evidence-based treatments, and so few do. It's really, really hard, and it's why we're losing so many people. You know, 350 people a day are dying from this disease. It's tragic, and it's even more tragic because it is preventable. When Nick, my son, got addicted, when it was clear he was disappearing, he was stealing from us, he was lying. I got a call from emergency room, you know, Mr. Chef, you better get here. Your son isn't going to make it. You know, I had no idea what to do. I called people I knew who'd been through this. I looked on the internet, completely overwhelmed. I ended up making the best decision I could. It was relying on a friend of a friend of a friend who told me that, you know, their child had gone into a program and had done well. I sent Nick there, and, you know, at least it got him off the streets. I mean, it didn't stop him from relapsing. He relapsed many times over the course of the next 10 years. But he was off the streets. He got some help. But they call this sort of a treatment trajectory. It takes a lot of time for some people, and it takes multiple treatments. Every relapse is dangerous, but often it takes multiple relapses before someone finally gets sober for good.
David Sheff, his new book, Clean, Overcoming Addiction and Ending America's Greatest Tragedy. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
What are your thoughts about America's addiction problem? You can tweet us at NPR Weekend, and I'm at NPR Scott Simon. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.